Welcome to Journal Club. I'm Clara Skuse. Today's episode is all about using atomic force microscopy to detect nano and microplastics in water. Before we start today's episode, I want to share three recent headlines with you. Microplastics Everywhere by Harvard Medical. Your brain is full of nanoplastics. Are they harming you? By Nature Journal. And recently on Euronews, scientists find most micro-nanoplastics in drinking water are smaller than EU detection limits. Right now, the discussion of microplastics is impossible to avoid. These synthetic polymer particles have pervaded every inch of our water cycle, and the problem is growing as the microplastics are shrinking. Smaller microplastics, or rather nanoplastics, can potentially reach more remote locations inside our bodies and even breach into our cells. We need to know what we're dealing with. How big are these micro-nanoplastics? How many are there? And how are they degrading? To answer these questions, researchers need to start using a new method of detection because the current laboratory techniques don't work for the smaller micro and nanoplastics. Not only that, we need to be able to see how these micro nanoplastics are degrading. Recent studies show that older micro nanoplastics have a habit of picking up nasty pollutants on their surface, like heavy metals, pesticides, and pharmaceuticals, all of which have their own effects on the body. In this paper, the researchers were trying to find a way to detect smaller micro nanoplastics below the normal detection limit in groundwater. In this episode of Journal Club, we'll examine how atomic force microscopy, or AFM, can help us quantify and characterize micro nanoplastics. We'll present the limitations with current detection methods, explain how AFM works, and lastly, show how these researchers analyzed the aging process of plastics using surface roughness. First, let's explain micro nanoplastics in a little more detail. Microplastics are fragments of plastic between 1 micrometer and 1 millimeter, which are formed as larger pieces of plastic break down. They usually enter the environment due to mismanagement of plastic waste from food packaging, consumer products, and many other avenues. Nanoplastics are between 1 micrometer and 1 nanometer in size. They're more abundant and reactive than microplastics and are a bigger cause of concern. Current spectroscopic techniques like Raman spectroscopy, Fourier transform infrared spectroscopy, and laser direct infrared are excellent for analyzing the exact chemical composition of the microplastics, but they cannot give accurate quantitative measurements for particles smaller than 10 micrometers. This leaves out nanoplastics altogether. Not only that, the current detection techniques have a high uncertainty when the micro-nanoplastics form a heteroaggregate. Let's go into that in more detail. Raman spectroscopy, Fourier transform infrared spectroscopy, and laser direct infrared operate in different ways, but principally they have some big similarities. Number one, they send out a beam of light or infrared radiation to the sample. Number two, some wavelengths of light are absorbed by the sample to generate what we call a spectrum, a unique fingerprint of the sample. Number three, this unique spectrum can be compared against a database of many known spectra to find a match. These techniques are very powerful in their own right and are able to accurately identify the exact chemical composition of the micro-nanoplastic. But they face difficulties when we're not dealing with a pure sample, but a lumpy, mysterious blob that is half soil and half micro-nanoplastics. This is the heteroaggregate. The soil itself generates its own spectrum that is superimposed onto the micro-nanoplastic spectrum, and suddenly it's hard to distinguish what's what. Scanning electron microscopy, or SEM, can achieve resolutions of less than 1 nanometer, which is certainly high enough to analyze the micro-nanoplastic fragments. However, this technique has high uncertainty when quantifying the surface roughness. We need something with a higher resolution than the aforementioned techniques, but with the ability to produce 3D reconstructions of the micro-nanoplastic morphology. These constructions would allow the calculation of surface roughness, which gives us information on how the plastics age. This is where AFM comes in. Atomic force microscopy feels its way across the surface of a material in these four steps. Number one, a very pointy probe with just a couple atoms at its tip is attached to a cantilever. The probe is gently brought down onto the surface, causing a close-range attractive force between the surface and the probe. Number two, this attractive force causes the cantilever to deflect towards the surface. A laser beam is used to measure this deflection. Number three, the probe is brought closer and closer until the atoms begin to crash into one another. At this point, there is a strong repulsive force from both of the positive nuclei screaming to stay away from one another. This repulsive force very slightly bends the cantilever in the opposite way and sends a signal that the probe should retreat. Number four, the probe lifts up, moves along slightly, and drops back down again. Number five, the first four steps are repeated again and again, scanning line by line across the surface of the sample and creating an image of the topology. AFM is a powerful technique, and yet it's relatively easy to use. I've personally used AFM in my research as it generates these gorgeous tactile 3D images that help you understand exactly what you're dealing with. It makes the small stuff come to life. Samples don't have to be in a vacuum like with SEM, so you see the samples in a more lifelike way. The only tricky part of setting up and using an instrument like this is manually loading the cantilever into the holder. Remember the probe that's only a couple of atoms? That has to be manually changed every so often. As the probe's job is literally to be dragged across sticky crap all day, it inevitably gets dirty and needs to be manually changed. The crap adheres to the probe and starts messing with the measurements. The probe and the cantilever are attached to a holder that is a tiny rectangle of 1.6 millimeters wide and 3.4 millimeters long. Changing this tiny little holder several times using tweezers and a magnifying glass is more witchcraft than science, and it doesn't help that each one costs about $130. You'd better hope your hands are steady and the holder doesn't ping out of your tweezers and fly across the room onto the floor. There's nothing quite like the pressure of changing a probe in the lab while Nigel, the extremely nimble and hawk-eyed lab technician, looks on with mild disapproval. Enough of that, let's get to the results. These researchers were particularly interested in looking at how the plastics were aging. When they age, micro-nanoplastics have a higher capacity to adsorb pollutants onto their surface, becoming pollutant carriers. Groundwater is actually most at risk of this pollutant carrier property because the particles have a long residence time inside of the aquifers. Since the aquifers expose them to abrasive friction forces, the surface of the nanoparticle becomes cracked, abrasive, and bumpy, increasing the roughness. A rougher surface means a higher capacity for pollutant adsorption. You might remember your chemistry classes at school when your teacher undoubtedly spoke about catalysts. Higher surface area equals higher rate of reaction. It's the same with our nanoplastics, except we don't want a reaction. We don't want to make it easier for species to adsorb onto the surface of the nanoplastics. And that's what environmental aging is doing. It's increasing the roughness of the plastic particle, leading to a higher uptake of pollutants. This is exactly what the researchers were able to measure and quantify at the nanometric level. In this paper, multi-frequency AFM was used in order to measure more subtle interactions between the probe and the micro-nanoplastic. Water samples were collected from different groundwater locations in China and were mixed with organic material in order to test whether the AFM could distinguish the micro-nanoplastics within the heteroaggregate. In the real groundwater samples, the researchers detected nanoplastics in the heteroaggregates that were between 1 and 5 micrometers in size. This is significant because these sizes are below the detection limit for the other techniques. Smaller nanoplastics will have different toxicities and different mechanisms of uptake in the body, so it's crucial that we can measure them and detect them in our water supplies. So what have we learned from this paper? That a new method has been developed to help us more accurately measure the amount of micro and nanoplastics present in our groundwater, as well as understand their morphology and likelihood to adsorb pollutants. This ultimately helps us understand what we're dealing with and what we need to consider in order to remove micro-nanoplastics from groundwater. AFM can't tell you the chemical composition of the plastic that you're dealing with, so these researchers aren't suggesting to totally replace the other techniques. Rather, AFM should be considered as a valuable addition. In my opinion, it would be really interesting to see if we could utilize the adsorption properties of nanoplastics, but in our favor. That way, if we remove the nanoplastics, we'd also remove the pollutants that had adhered on their surface. Two birds, one stone. We'd be removing both the nanoplastics and the harmful pollutants in one step. If you've got time, I recommend that you open up the PDF to have a look at the AFM images that we've been discussing together. You'll also find a breakdown of how the researchers used the elastic modulus to distinguish between newer and older micro-nanoplastics. Today's episode of Journal Club was written and performed by me, Clara Skuse, with written support from Malcolm Dix. It was produced by Luis Lopez. Hope you enjoyed it, and we'll see you tomorrow.